Hey everyone, I'm Angela.
And I'm Andy.
And welcome to The Magistream, a podcast for Magestans by Magestans. Please note that the podcast The Magistream is not to be confused with the in-game Magistream, a wave of living magic that refreshes a Magestan's health and abilities at sunrise.
On this episode of The Magestream, we will be visiting one of Magesta's own creative artisans, Karen Hobbs. We'll be discussing the Shadow Realm and its recent war.
Hear a song performed by Game Master Paul Debkowski.
Answer questions about the net worth of a human soul, and delve deep into the lore surrounding Irvinshire nobility. Remember that Magistry is a fluid game with a very active and constantly changing world. Even though the information in this podcast is valid and true, you might be able to find out more information with info gathers, and information may become invalid with the passing of time or more research, or, you know,
people
time travel.
Don't understand it. Say I'm too old to believe in magic. Your only limit is what you can imagine. So come and listen, la 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 la. You're still dreaming of your last plot. After game ends, do you feel lost? Are you worried we forgot you? Introducing the Magistream. Come ask Scribe and anything. Be your bridge between the games. People don't understand it. Say I'm too old to believe in magic. The only limit is what you can imagine. So come and listen, la 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 la. So come and listen, la 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 la.
Welcome to the podcast and to our first segment called Profession Artisan, where we talk to one of Magistry's super creative people about the hobbies and jobs that they do to enhance their LARP experience, and really everyone's around them. Today, we are chatting with Karen Hobbs. Karen is currently a permanent NPC and plot writer at Magistry. She has also played the game. Her character's name was Monashisha, but eventually she made her way to the dark side and excels in engaging players, writing intricate, detailed, and roleplay-heavy plots. Karen is also an extremely talented seamstress specializing in durable, LARP-friendly costuming, and owns her own business called Sabo's Costuming. You can find her on Facebook. So hi, Karen. Welcome to the Magistream.
Hello.
So this is our segment. We just wanted to have an interview with you about what you do. So I believe Andy has the first question.
Oh, yeah. So, Karen, how long have you played Magistry?
I actually played very briefly. I started playing in 2008. Then I soon realized I was going to have a little boy. And then I took a break for a little while.
Colbert!
And when I had decided to change companies, because Magistry was so welcoming, I decided to try my hand at NPCing at Magistry. And I think nice. I found a new home that way.
Nice. Have you done other LARPs? How long have you been LARPing?
I started LARPing in 1994. I've been creating NPC garb for 4 LARPs now, and I've enjoyed them all.
How long have you been sewing and making costuming?
Well, the funny thing is I started making clothing when I was about 17 years old. And I started specifically for people such as myself that could not buy off the rack. I had a lot of curves. If I wore anything too tight, it was getting the wrong attention, too loose, and it wasn't getting any attention. So I started creating my own clothes. And then around the age of 20, I started going to Renaissance fairs. And my friends and I would go every day of every weekend for the entire time they ran. And that's nice. How I started making Renaissance clothes and my introduction to LARPing, because we were very interactive with the audiences.
Okay, so that answers my next question, was how did you get into it? So Renaissance fairs.
Yeah, Renaissance. We would go, like I said, every weekend, 8-10 weekends straight, had a great time. The owners of the fair knew us. All the cast people at the fair knew us. The vendors at the fair knew us, and we just kind of became part of that group.
Did you make costumes for your friends too, or was it just mostly for you?
I think my friends and I got together and we started working together to create costumes. And as we would buy pieces from the fairs, we would take them apart, literally, and figure out how they were made and make new ones.
Make your own.
Yeah.
Neat.
So what was the very first costume you ever made? Do you remember?
Well, if you mean the one when I was 17, it would be I was sponsoring a Christmas event, and I decided to make the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come. So
that's
there was
awesome.
A lot of spirit in that.
What did it? Oh, was it just was like a spirit robe or?
Oh no, it looked like a dark wraithy kind of shadowy kind of thing. Go figure.
You're still making those.
I'm still making dark shadowy kind of figures.
What are your favorite things to make? Is it that kind of stuff or is it something else?
It's funny. My favorite thing to make is something that I'm really inspired to make. I will not say it's one particular thing. It's usually when someone's telling me about a character and then I go into, like, I can almost see that character and then start making what I think that character would wear.
Do you have a favorite costume, like, that you've ever made?
Yeah, that would be a werewolf costume that I made for my brother-in-law. It had an internal bodysuit that had all the muscles and everything built in it and the reverse knees and everything. And then over that was the fur werewolf. I mean, it was really deluxe long fur werewolf. So it moved like there was muscles underneath it. It was very neat.
So cool.
I didn't make a pattern off of it, and I've really never made that one again.
Do you have pictures?
I do have a picture, yes.
You should send it to me, and I'll put it up, right now. And people who are listening to the podcast, look at this frame right here, and you'll see the picture of the werewolf costume that Karen is making.
Oh, I can do that, sure.
Cool. So I know that we talked about this last night when I was asking you to do this segment, and you were about your commissions process. And I know that it's different from most people who take commissions, so you want to talk a little bit about what that looks like and, like, you know, tell you what your visions are and if you happen to make it.
Okay. I do take some commissions. I think one of the good examples of when I take a commission is when I get that inspiration. I'm usually talking to a person about their character and what they're looking for. My heart always goes out to those individuals that can't just buy off the rack, especially my big and tall guys. And people that are really looking for something for their character. So I guess when we're having a conversation, the extrovert part of me is inspired by that person's ideas. Because I'm a little bit of an artist, so I have to feel the piece.
You have to be inspired.
I do have to be inspired. Yeah. I mean, I will do things like the NPC monster pants and stuff that we've designed. I can do those in my sleep. And I do.
Those monster pants are our favorites, by the way. Magistry has, if you've ever NPC'd at Magistry and you've thrown on a pair of pants that ties at the waist, has pockets, and ties at the bottom, those are Karen's famous NPC monster pants, and they are our favorites.
They are, yep, they were designed before the NPC need of, NPC costumes have to fit almost anyone at any time. So there's a lot of drawstring waists and a lot of pockets and, you know, the cuffs can tie up or down depending on the weather. My brother started designing them and I took it off from there and made other modifications.
They're great. I love them.
Well, that's good.
So you've done the Market of the Moons. Has Sabo's Costuming been to other Ren fairs or conventions?
No. I'm really kind of having a hard time keeping up with, I get a lot of requests. Market of the Moons generate a lot of requests and a lot of really inspired pieces that I want to make. And just with my daytime commitments, I have not really had a chance to get to them, which is what wintertime is for. And I'm actually looking forward to making some of those costumes that the people I talked to at the Mark of the Moons gave me some really great ideas on what they were looking for. And the way I work with my commission is what I like, what I'm hearing from someone, what they're looking for, especially when I get multiple requests for something very similar, then when I start looking for fabric, because I have to find the fabric at the right price. And when I find the fabrics, then I'll start making those for those people. So I don't take any money up front for those commission jobs. I take them when the item's complete, and then I just email them and go, hey, this is done if you're interested. It's part of that unusual commissions thing.
Right.
So what are you working on right now? Give us some details.
Well, I just finished a beautiful SCA dress for one of my girlfriends, Ms. Lynn Dye, who's going to an event very soon. And when I finished the dress and the underdress, I decided that her escort, her husband, needed to look sharp too, so I made him a tunic as well. Okay, so my current projects I'm working on are a new samurai pant. One of the pieces that were really liked at the Mark of the Moons were based on a warlord-style pant, which was the NPC monster pants where I attached the loincloth. The new version of that is actually going to be based on a samurai-cut pant with the loincloth attached. And part of the reason for that is it's got that fantasy look. But in reality, when I'm doing, I do a lot of fighting with martial arts, and I also fight in the costumes to try and figure out what works best and what just doesn't work as an NPC. And so it's experimenting with lengths and cuts and how much fabric and the weight. And I've had some people play testing them. And the result...
You might see this on... Oh, geez, I just blanked on his name. Chris Adams' character.
KG?
KG, thank you. KG is one of the playtesters. Sorry, Chris. I love you still, I promise.
So I'm playtesting that. They were a pretty big hit at the Mark of the Moons, so I'm working on some new styles of that with his feedback and about some of the lengths and cuts and everything. And so that's probably a new piece coming out. Again, I make some of the designs myself, and it's a mix of fantasy and practical, being able to fight and move in. Of course, samurai pants, you can certainly fight and move in. So,
sure.
That's awesome. I can't wait to see the new prototypes. So what is your general price range? And I know that that's a huge question because you make everything from, small accessories to giant, beautiful pieces like the dress that you just made, which we'll also put pictures of in our thing. But so can you give us like price ranges for various pieces?
Well, that's interesting because with my LARP crowd, I try to build to a price range. The cost of fabrics itself has gone up in price quite a bit. But I try to work with what it is reasonable for someone to pay. So a lot of times when I'm making, for example, a men's shirt, I think it's reasonable to pay $5 for a men's shirt. And I start thinking when you get into like $100 for a shirt, I just think it's too much.
Right, right. Hmm.
My goals are, like for a shirt, a standard shirt would be $45 to... it could be as much as $85, but you're talking about a shirt, like the tunic, which had a whole lot of trim and specialty and a lot of work put into it. So it depends on how much work and how fancy something is. But at the same time, I'm also working really hard to make them affordable. I'm searching for the right fabrics. I'm trying to get the right deals on it. So that's where custom work really, I lose so much in what I'm able to do because I'm actually looking for a particular fabric. And I think people sometimes forget, I don't actually weave the fabric. So, when it costs $50 a yard, that's what it costs.
Right.
So you have to start with that.
Yeah.
Right. So you can you can look for a pretty standard price. And the great thing about Karen's work, too, about your work, Karen, is that it is extremely durable. Karen is a very veteran LARPer, so the costuming that she makes is meant to be LARPed in. And Magistries NPCs, they do a number on our costuming, but most of Karen's stuff, just holds up. If you own a piece from Karen, it's going to hold up. And it's going to last you a good long time because it's made like that. And Karen really does try to keep the prices down on her stuff. But if you want something that's just covered in trim and covered in beautiful fabrics, you know, that's when you can expect the price to go up.
Right. And sometimes I just tell the person to go out and go get me 6 yards of the fabric you want.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then I just put labor on top of it. I mean, you know, I've told people before, I go, yeah, go get me 10 yards of trim and you cover that. So, yeah, when I had, for example, I asked someone when they're out at Penzic to go pick up 10 yards of trim that they would want on their garb. Or I would ask someone to go, you know, especially if I'm having a particularly difficult time where I'm saying, well, what about this fabric or that fabric? Well, a lot of designers I know will charge you for their shopping time.
Right.
So, and that's where you get into, you know, wedding dresses costing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
Right.
I prefer, if it's really getting that special, say, well, you go find 6 yards of something that you like and then give that to me.
Right. And then they can, you know, be assured that they're, you know, if they want to cut costs on the fabric, well, then that's on them. Hmm. So that's good.
So what advice would you give to new people trying to get into costuming or sewing as a hobby, particularly for LARPing?
I would say always start with a basic tea tunic. It's the easiest, simplest piece to cut. It's the simplest piece to sew. It's literally two seams from the wrist down the side. And then they can work on adding trim and getting the comfort and feel of it. So that'd be my advice, is always start with the tea tunic and they can build on it from there.
I know you didn't ask me, Andy, but my advice is never use stretch velvet.
Okay.
At least not when you're first starting out.
All right, pick a cotton. Pick a cotton tea tunic.
Well, awesome, Karen. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find Karen's work on Facebook. You can just look up Sabo. That's SEBBOH, Sabo's Costuming on Facebook. And you also have a website to buy straight off of, don't you?
I do. It's on it's a Square account, and it should be linked onto the Sabo site.
Right. So if you go to her Facebook page, you can actually go straight to where she actually has items up for sale. And we'll put a link to her Facebook page in the notes on our YouTube channel, so you can click from there.
I suppose I should update that site then on what's for sale.
You can also probably just message Karen straight from her Facebook, from Sabo's Facebook page, and she can talk to you there as well. So thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
We have another knowledge segment for you this episode, Knowledge Dimensions. We're going to be talking about the Shadow Rebellion and Civil War that's been raging in the Shadow Realm for 8 years or so and was recently concluded as of this year.
So we're going to start off with talking about the Shadow Rebellion, which started with the Shadow Queen Virilgana versus the Penumbra of Truth. Virilgana wanted to open an astral corridor to Dayan's Shadow Realm and merge the two Shadow Realms, so Majesta's Shadow Realm and Dayan's Shadow Realm. So let me give you a little bit of a background on Dayant, because many of you probably don't know what that is. Dayant is the world that the overworlder Deathorn created before he was an overworlder. And we're not going to go into too much what overworlders are, but suffice it to say that they are kind of like incarnations, but they're incarnations for all of the dimensions in the Dabbleverse, not just Majesta. Yeah. So Dayant was created by Deathorn. It exists in its own astral plane, unlike Majesta. Like Majesta shares its astral plane with a whole bunch of other dimensions, but Dayant exists and is in its own little bubble. And because it's in its own little bubble, it's really, really difficult to travel to. Generally, hoppers can't do it normally, which is why the Shadow Queen wanted to create a permanent corridor to Dayant for her own use. And she tried to do this in a couple of ways. First off by... She just wanted to get the one portal, permanent portal to Dayant.
Yeah, to be able to get in and out of Dayant more
right.
easily.
The reason that she wanted to do this is because on Dayant, their Shadow Realm has much more influence over the world of Dayant than Majesta's Shadow Realm has over Majesta. So she was really interested in trying to merge the realms so that she could increase the use the energy and the creatures from Dayant to increase our shadow realms.
Shadow power.
Right. Power and influence. So yeah, that's a little bit of what of why Dayant plays into this.
And on the other hand, the Penumbra of Truth were shadows that wanted to keep Majesta's Shadow Realm unmerged in the natural state that it had been. There were a group that follows the teaching of an ancient shadowmancer named Nisarl.
Nisarl,
who was instrumental in bringing about order to the chaotic nature of the Shadow Realm and allowing it to be harnessed by common shadow creatures for the purposes of casting magic. Elond and Obsidian are noted members of that group, the Penumbra of Truth. And after the Shadow Queen tried to merge her Shadow Realm with Dance, they began to train denizens of Majesta in the arts of shadow magic, which was not looked upon favorably by the Shadow Queen and her minions. They wanted to get rid of the Penumbra of Truth and any Majestans who dared try to use shadow magic.
There was quite a bit of back and forth between the Penumbra of Truth and the Shadow Queen until such time as the spirit of Alien the Pure showed up and Luther Hungsinger, who was one of our PCs, became his avatar.
Yeah, so Alien the Pure was a great hero long ago in the dimension of Opula. His people were a golden-skinned race and lived in perpetual daylight. When Alien was captured by shadow creatures from another world, they tortured him to death. He was more than just a warrior. He was also a potent spiritualist, and his dying completed a very powerful spiritualism ritual. He became a vengeful spirit, and his spirit has continued for millennia. His spirit walk has continued for millennia and has spanned across countless dimensions.
So the first recorded appearance of the spirit of Alien the Pure on Majesta was at the beginning of the Age of Arrival, which is when the Mongrelians first came to Majesta. Alien helped many people while he was here during that time, especially Mongrelian refugees in the less welcoming parts of the world. Today, Alien remains a folk hero to most Mongrelians.
Yeah, interesting note on the Mongrelians, they don't have counterparts on the Shadow Realm, and Shadows didn't like that since it gave Majesta's material realm an advantage over them. So, especially since so many Mongrelians were arriving at once at the beginning of the Age of Arrival.
Tens of thousands.
So the Shadow, So the Shadows attacked, focusing on the Mongrelians when they could, and were winning the war until...
Well, they weren't entirely winning. They were just making their presence very well known. It wasn't like there were shadows swarming everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shadow war, not a out-in-public war.
Right.
But also, it's a shadow war.
Shadow-shadow war.
It's a shadow-shadow war. But anyway, so Alien the Pure was reaching his perigee, the height of his power, on Majesta, and he flew into a rage and began wreaking destruction against all things shadow, continuing his vengeance upon any realms and creatures of darkness, and kind of went a little out of control.
Well, that's kind of his MO. So Alien the Pure is generally a pretty good guy until he reaches that perigee, and he just gets filled with this sun-drunk rage and ends up going into a destructive mode that needs to be stopped. And Skillion Azkabor, who is a Shadowmancer in the Shadow Realm.
The Shadowmancer. As I've heard it.
Right. He's been stopping Alien the Pure on every one of his perigees by cutting off his sword hand and casting him back into the cosmos. So he did this over 2,000 years ago during his first perigee, and he's done it two other times since. He cuts off Alien's hand, and generally the hand is either found or passed down through history, but this hand, was found by members of the Golden Swords, which is an organization that Alien helped to found on Majesta. And it was kept by the Golden Swords until the next host was ready for it, 1,000 or so years later after his second perigee. Or, 1,000 years later, and then it would happen again, and then 1,000 years later, and we're at the third perigee right now, on Majesta anyway. And so, the spirit of Alien returns to Majesta every 1,000 years or so, and his latest appearance began in Luther Hungsinger, in 2006 of the Age of Arrival. And I cannot believe that it has been a full decade since we wrote that plot. So that's beyond me.
That was before my time.
And yeah, I apologize. The spirit of Alien's latest perigee happened 8 years ago. So that would be, in in-game terms, that would be year 119 of the Age of Fortune. No. Hmm. Yes.
Yes, Age of Fortune. Yes.
Was when that's when it reaches perigee, and that's when you see Luther moving into the Shadow Realm for his assault.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it was in Bone Harvest of 118 of the Age of Fortune, the Brotherhood of the Phoenix, with other people from Elmerton, fought their way through the Shadow Realm and released the Phoenix, which had been imprisoned there for over a century, and then fought their way back out, and Luther stayed behind in the Shadow Realm, and that's when Alien the Pure came out and rampaged through the Shadow Realm, killing Vro'Gana, the last Shadow Queen.
And that's usually what we refer to, like we've been referring to, as the perigee. The perigee of Alien is when it comes upon you and you get fueled by this rage.
And then after that, the Shadowmancer, Gillian Askapor, defeated him and started the cycle over again, I guess.
Yeah, he cut off his sword hand and sent him back into the cosmos so that Alien would go find a new host on another world. And Luther was cast back onto Majesta, where, unfortunately, he was killed by shadows that were chasing him. It was very sad. And that started a whole new series of things, a whole new storyline that includes Vorkarion, but we won't get into that right now. Now, we're going to talk about what happens after a Shadow Queen is killed. And, you know, we're going to lead that into the ascension of a new queen. So when a Shadow Queen is killed, her essence and what makes her up explodes into thousands of shards that just, you know, scatter throughout the Shadow Realm. And they go into people, they kind of go into things, they just scatter. And that starts a competition, which is meant to discern a new queen. And how that is done is that anyone who fancies themselves to be a contender for the throne of Shadow Queen begins a hunt for these shards. And, you know, an interesting thing about the shards is that once they're inside a person or a shadow or a being, the only known way, or maybe it's just the most efficient way to collect them, is to kill that person, which then kind of frees the shard up to come into you. So.
Yeah. I heard that we did know that there were other ways to transfer them, but still killing the person with the shards was the easiest and least energy intensive way to transfer a shard.
It's the most efficient, and generally, you know, this is kind of a thing that the shadows have been doing, you know, since tradition dictated it however many years ago. So they don't particularly care to look for a new way to do it.
Sure.
In fact, I remember going out as a Lond and just being someone asking me if there's a better way to do it. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not going to expend the energy to really look for it. If you guys want to look for it, I'll see what I can do to help. But
sure.
She's like, this is just really the most efficient way to do it. So as you might imagine, this causes quite a bit of chaos in the Shadow Realm when anyone and everyone is trying to garner enough shards to become a potential candidate. And it's only been in the last probably 4 or 5 years that two potential candidates for the throne have, you know, really, really rose up and really kind of identified themselves to the Shadow Realm and were really kind of like justified or recognized by the Shadow Realm as being the highest potential candidates. And that was Alond and Rebecca Skye.
Yeah. So went on for a long time, especially, and Rebecca Skye was an outsider. She was a non-shadow who was a contender to become the Shadow Queen.
Which had never happened before.
Which had never happened.
That we know of.
She used, like, unorthodox methods and gathered a lot of allies, including, you know, various other people, but...
especially the use of Dark Star.
Yeah. She was casting by the power of the Dark Stars. But with a lot of help from Elmerton... including Silver, Oliver, Dante, Galen. She was deposed, and a new shadow Shadow contender appeared with the sponsorship of Elond, who apparently had never intended to become the queen, or to get Kina Tagari on the throne.
Right. So for most of Elond's time with the town, and she was trying to get them to make her queen and to collect shards for her, her actual intention was to get Kina Tagari on the throne. And so she was collecting shards for her. So Elmerton did, in fact, kill Rebecca Skye.
May she rest in peace.
That's very nice of you.
That's Simon's song that he dedicated a song to Rebecca Skye. May she rest in peace.
Well, you know, Simon, if you're listening to this, maybe you should put that on our command perform segment. Yeah. I would love to hear it because I've never heard it. Oh, yeah. So the town killed Rebecca. May she rest in peace. And Kina Tagari has been properly placed to take the throne with a majority of the support of the Shadow Realm behind her. Of course, as far as I know, the coronation has not always happened, or has not yet happened. So we'll see what happens with that. But we're going to talk a little bit about the main players, and we did reference them above a little bit. But the main players in this civil war, this ascension to the throne of Shadow Queen. And, of course, there was my character, Elond. Elond was actually one of the leaders of the Penumbra of Truth and one of the people that was helped, you know, be responsible for the takedown of Vril'Gana and the closing of the portal to Dayan. She's, you know, battle-hardened. She's a guerrilla fighter. And she's basically, you know, fought her way up the totem pole and has earned respect and status within the Shadow Realm. So when she was one of the main contenders, she really didn't get a whole lot of pushback from that. People were like, oh, of course she is. That just makes sense. And one of the things about the Penumbra of Truth, one of the tenets that was formed on, is that they deeply respect, or they deeply feel that the Shadow Realm needs to maintain its purity on Majesta. And she really didn't want it to merge with Dayan. She's like, no, this is Majesta's Shadow Realm. It is its own thing, and it needs to remain its own thing. So while she kind of has that, you know, need for purity there, she also has no problem allying herself with Majesta proper, and she's taken a particular fancy to Elmerton and its inhabitants.
Yeah, the other contender for Shadow Queen has also had a fascination with Elmerton and its inhabitants, but for different reasons. Rebecca Skye was the matriarch of the Blackgate family, or at least the cannibalistic branch of it. But the Blackgates were some of the original settlers of Elmerton until they were outcast and burrowed underneath the town to live when Rebecca's husband performed necromancy and was executed for the crime of necromancy. And the Blackgates swore revenge. Bosephus, Rebbe's brother-in-law?
I
think it's brother-in-law.
I'd have to look to be sure.
I think she married Bosephus's brother.
I think that's correct, yes.
Went so far as to swear a blood oath against his brother's executioners. And the split within the family occurred when the food situation became desperate living underground and cannibalism was resorted to by Rebecca's Blackgates while Bosephus's tried to find other means of sustenance.
And Rebecca, at one point in her constant quest for power and her, you know, desire to, yeah, maybe it was to better herself or to take care of her family, but she did become shadow touched at one point. And this was done primarily with an alliance with a dark star creature, one of the three dark star creatures that is currently, or was currently living in the Evernight. And once she got that kind of shadow element to her, and she knew about the contest to become the Shadow Queen, she noticed that vacuum and decided that she wanted to fill it. So she began collecting shards, and she began working to become the Shadow Queen, and eventually forced all of her family to take on elements of shadow in an effort to create the perfect shadow crossbreed that could potentially thrive both in the Shadow Realm and on Majesta proper.
Like a shadow amphibian.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, Rebecca was, yeah, she was innovative and persuasive. She tried controlling the Darkwalker by making it the task of her consorts. She had a bunch of support in the Shadow Realm from mistreated and outcast shadows. People say that she treated the shadows better than most of the other powerful shadows in the Shadow Realm did. She made alliances with the Gatekeeper. She had a Mortisant in her court, a powerful alchemist, a vampire prince that allowed her more avenues for power than the tradition-bound like shadows would have. She particularly disliked Elmerton after they thwarted her attempts to gain the throne and tended to favor Alond. But she did maintain a soft spot for Oliver. They had a bit of a relationship going on after there was that vision that we had of the future, that dinner.
Oh, that was such dinner a mod good where dinner we, mod.
Yeah, it's my favorite dinner mod of all my time, PC.
So we had, during this event, we had been having the town go back and forth in between little time bubbles. I forget exactly what you had to do now, but they had to go into different time bubbles and alter what was happening in those time bubbles.
Yeah, there was various things. Rakesh was involved in one of them. He was like gaining power from the orc clan that hated Hurog or something. There was all kinds of stuff going on. But like, yeah, there would be like a horn that would go off when one of those time bubbles was happening, and we'd, you know, follow the sound of the horn and go off there. And Rakesh and I were in the tavern, and we heard the horn go off up at the top of the hill at the manor house. And we look at each other, and he says, "Is that horn for a time jump or is it dinner?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Let me go out and check." And then a couple NPCs come in rags, and they're talking about, like, "We're having dinner, and there's gonna be real meat." And I go in and I tell Rakesh, like, "Apparently, it's both. Like, it's both dinner and time travel to a bleak, dark future."
Oh, it was so bleak. One of my favorite things about that. So we actually, you know, we tried to set up the dinner mod, so it was like a little bit shabbier than usual. And we definitely had a couple of tables on the ground, and our NPCs would just sit on the ground and we're just eating like off the floor, basically.
Yeah.
And we had, this is my favorite thing, and I have to say, this was entirely Jeff Mitchell's doing, was this cake. Yeah. We had a cake for dessert. And Oliver had told my server, my NPC server, that the cake read "Happy Birthday," and he had written on it,
it was in majestic
script. So you couldn't actually read what it said unless you were able to read.
Like, I looked at it, I'm like, that does not say happy birthday.
It was so good because it said, "There is no hope for tomorrow." But the best part was is that he couldn't even finish it because he didn't have enough icing. So, like, it just looked like he had used the last of his resources to write "There is no hope for tomorrow" on the cake.
And I was I could see that it was majestic script, and this was like one of my first couple of games, actually. So I wasn't that good at reading it yet. And I was trying to like copy it down while you were cutting the cake.
And I was so happy because I was like, "We're going to have cake."
Yeah. You were cutting the cake, and like, I was trying to like copy it down as you were cutting off pieces of the words and giving them away. And I'm just like, write faster.
I do remember like really having to keep a straight face because TJ as Sindo came up at one point, and he was actually pretty good at reading magic script.
Yeah, like he can read that like so
easily.
And
so he started reading it, and I watched his face just like it went from like interest to like, "Oh my god, what is happening?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, it says happy birthday, right?" And he just looked at me, and he looked at the person next to him, and he looked at me, and he's like, "Yeah, that's absolutely what it says." Oh my gosh, that was so good. So that's why Rebecca actually came in during that dinner, and you know, you could see that she and Oliver in this time bubble had had maintained a relationship. All, you know, they were like basically king and queen. At that point,
I was worried that meat was people, because like, she's a cannibal. Like I was like, but like it's pork, and I'm like, pork, right? Like pork or pork.
Yeah. So the thing was is that, like, Rebecca remembered that vision just the same way as Oliver remembered it. So she remembered a future in which she and Oliver, like, had complete control, and she really liked it. So that kind of gave her a soft spot for him for the rest of her living time on Majesta.
That was a dark, like, Oliver was dark, and, like, he beat you, didn't he?
Yeah,
like,
I dropped a bunch of plates, and he just, complete accident. I dropped a whole pile of plates, and I looked up at him, and he looked up at me, and then I ran back into the kitchen, and, like.
Yeah, and then he followed you, and then you, like, let up, like, oh, a blood-curdling scream, like, only you can do, and everyone is, like, just looking around, like, what is going on?
Oh, man, that was a good mod. Oh, goodness. Oh. All right. So, yeah, that was a really long-winded way of saying that Rebecca, like, just has a soft spot for Oliver.
Sure. Anyway, so she was finally defeated with the help of Bocephus, who sacrificed his blood after swearing another blood oath, this time against Rebecca Skye, his sister-in-law, and that allowed... the town to get the power to help kill her. Elmerton finally killed her, fulfilled an obscure prophecy about the joining of two powerful swords that were wielded by Silver and Oliver. And her death secured the throne for Alond, who didn't actually want the throne, who just wanted to hand it over to the third contender.
Right, and that's Kina Tagari. And just as a, you know, in case you're wondering, we're not going to say a whole heck of a lot about Kina right now because she is still a very major player. And we want the information that we want you to find, you know, to learn about her, we want you to foig that, to find out in game. But what we can tell you is that Kina Tagari is the daughter of the former Shadow Queen, Vril'Gana, and she was set up and sponsored by Alond. Alond the Queenmaker, in order to take the throne in complete secrecy. Alond didn't actually tell anybody that she was setting this up until it was pretty much almost done, as shadows do. And she, Kina Tagari, is now the near undisputed Shadow Queen, and the hope is that her reign will bring order to the chaos of the realm, but it's also almost certainly going to bring changes. A lot of that is, because of the different ways in which Rebecca went about trying to secure her position as the Shadow Queen. She did a lot of unorthodox things and changed a lot of rules. So, yep. And the thing that I've been playing...
Like she found ways to transfer Shadow Shards that didn't involve...
Yeah,
people,
yeah.
For example.
And she also changed, like, the task of consort. She had that going before she was even queen, which is usually not something that you can do until after you're queen.
That was an unorthodox move.
Right. So there's going to be changes in the Shadow Realm, but generally just having a stable queen figure is good, you know, and will bring a little bit more order and will probably end the civil war that's been going on for you know, years now.
Yeah.
There are a few other participants in the Shadow War or the Shadow War that we do want to mention a little bit. There's Lyrissa. Lyrissa was a warden of Rebecca Skye for a while, and she was actually one of she ended up betraying Rebecca at one point and helped Silver and Oliver and Dante and Galen actually. Helped to defeat Rebecca Skye in the long run. There's Obsidian, who is a member of the Penumbra of Truth as well. And there's also Skilliard Askerbor, who, as we mentioned, is a powerful Shadowmancer in the Shadow Realm. But they all have roles that are ongoing, and we also, you know, would like you to learn more about them in-game. And that was a really good... knowledge dimensions.
Yeah.
So you're welcome.
There's like three legend lores in there.
Three legend lores and like at least two or three like plots, personal plots from PCs. So
several of them from the same person.
That's true. Just can't get enough of those shadows.
But different PCs. Yeah. All right. At this point, we'd like to take a break now and recognize one of our sponsors for the show. Today's sponsorship is brought to you by the If You Can Dream It Super Bracked Tane for Dreamweaver Harkin 2016.
Vote Dreamweaver Harkin for Favorite Villain 2016 and let the world know that she is the villain of your dreams. If they ask if you are a donor, you have to say yes.
Brought to you by the Bracked Brim Action Committee Tane. They are in no way coordinated with their candidate because she's dead.
Thanks, Elmer Bama. Now we would like to invite you to listen to a performance by Game Master Paul Dubkowski. It's time for our segment, Command Perform.
Clear light on a slick palm, as I miss the hill the day, slip the knife from a shade back, make a marked card play. Call twilight hours down from a heaven home, high above the highest bidder for the good Lord's throne. Wee hours I'll meet you down by Gunring Hill, and we'll watch the old gods play by Gunring Hill, by Gunring Hill. We'll wait in stone circles till the force comes through. Mind joint in faint discord as the storm watch brews. A concert of kings as the white sea snaps, at the heels of a soft prayer whisper. In the wee hours I'll meet you down by Dunring Hill, oh, and I'll take you quickly by Dunring Hill, by Dunring Hill.
That was Dunring Hill, written by Ian Anderson, who is the inspiration for Eander, Majesta's incarnation of music. Dunring Hill is also the final song performed by Paul's NPC, Amos the Minstrel, as the incarnation of Devastation used the music as the vehicle to rip Amos' soul from his body. Previously, Devastation had sent Eander to the Abyss. Eander's voice was able to escape the Abyss, and it happened to inhabit Amos, which is why Devastation came to rip it from him. Calum and friends eventually retrieved the voice, and it was returned to Eander after the good guys finally won and put Devastation back in his box. Thanks, Paul, for that performance.
Welcome to Ask Ryben Anything. The opinions expressed here are for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing legal advice. The opinions of Ryben Van Holt may not reflect the opinions of Magistry staff and may be factually untrue. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome, especially when time travel is involved. Oh, hello there. I was just sitting in front of this fireplace in my large bookshelf, enjoying a spiced wine and reading some letters. Here's the letter now. Rularu writes, if you throw an isosceles triangle out the window of a carriage that was moving 40 miles per hour, factoring in wind resistance and all that, how many cupcakes can I buy with one human soul? Okay. So, disregarding the non sequitur about triangles, this question is about the cupcake to soul exchange rate, correct? This is a bit outside of my area of expertise. While I haven't heard of anyone who gives cupcakes in exchange for souls, per se, the grandmother does turn children into baked goods. I'd really recommend steering clear of her and her wares, though. Even leaving out the moral compunctions, consuming her gifts can have unpleasant side effects. Demons of the Abyss have been known to value intangible things in their bargains, but I've never known them to sell cupcakes. Anything is possible, though, I suppose. Moving on. Arvili writes, who are important people in town to talk to if we need a service provided? Well, this is another good question, and goes along with a question asked last time. Most of the people I mentioned who can teach skills can also provide services as well. But beyond that, Semeril can provide leather goods and armor repair. Rakesh and Magnus are majestic smiths, and are thus good at smithing, crafting, and enchanting. Rakesh has merchant contacts that are useful if you're interested in buying or selling items. Sebastian, Kale, and Said are also helpful in that regard. Kale is also a brewer and can provide all sorts of unusual beverages. He can also craft locks, I believe, if you need them. When it comes to enchanting, I'd recommend Galin. Many other skilled spellcasters can enchant magical items as well, but he has the most experience. He also has a number of other skills at his disposal for sending messages, identifying items, and so on. Raynan can provide magical healing and disease removal. I think Volin can do this as well. Arvili asked this question, but he can provide burial services, if necessary, for those of you listening. For mercenary services, there are several good options available, including the Ebon Wolves and Frey Fiddlesticks' group. The Maestros can provide entertainment services, but Silver is a skilled entertainer as well, though in a more subtle way. When it comes to information, while I'll admit I am the most obvious source, there are others who can provide information and track down answers to questions, again, in a subtler way. There are other more discreet services that can be obtained locally. I'm not sure how many would like to be named publicly, but feel free to write me a letter or see me after class. Oh, did Bram mention that he is an assassin?
Our next segment is where we delve into some of the lore that exists at Magistry. The topic for this segment was suggested by Kristen Jacobson, a.k.a. Valen. Kristen asked about the other noble houses at game and their significance in the world. We talked about Lavendros in our first episode, so she wanted to know about the others as well. This is a huge topic. There are so many noble houses, and their influence in Irvineshire is pretty massive. But we're going to cover the bullet points of Irvineshirean nobility here. So our current noble structure, as many noble structures do, I suppose, started off as clans throughout the area that would become the Kingdom of Irvineshire. They developed, you know, blood ties. They developed leadership ties, and they fought each other during the Age of War, when everyone was fighting each other. The end of the Age of War and the Age of Tears saw the first signs of the formation of houses and people banding together and congregating under various leaders. It did take hundreds of years to kind of solidify those clans, and I'm sure lots and lots of conflict, but eventually the houses started to come together and started to gel, and they did begin to fight one another again over leadership of the entire kingdom. In the end, there were three major unification meetings, called the Three Unification Meetings, during this time, during which a hierarchy was established between the houses and during which they were more officially recognized. Brexiano and Stellacci were the most powerful and influential houses, and were deeply embroiled in conflict with one another over who would eventually have that ruling seat, who would be the high ruler, the king. And this went back and forth over the course of a couple decades. House Brighthand, which is the current ruling house of Irvineshire, also had a lot of power. But when they saw this fight going on between Stellacci and Brexiano, they kind of stepped in as a mediator and became the ruling house, saying that, okay, kids, you know, you've had enough. Daddy's stepping in, and I'm going to rule until you guys can figure this out, is basically what happened. And so once Stellacci and Brexiano figured out who is most fit, then the change could be made over. However, that change has not yet been made, and Brighthand has been mostly in control ever since.
That's a long time.
It is a long time, and I'm going to go ahead and be fair and say that we don't have the entire history of the world written out from the age of tears forward. That's a whole heck of a lot of time. So I'm sure that Brighthand
going
has...
back 5,000 years.
we don't have that entirely written out. So I'm sure that Brighthand has not been ruling the entire time. But there, it has been ruling for a very good chunk of time. And this is where the caveat at the beginning of the episode comes in, where things, you know, it is a very fluid world. And as we, as people research things and as we write more about them, things can change. So, you know, just to keep that in mind.
You mean that my ideas could possibly influence the history of Majesta if I write really good stuff in my backstory?
Or even if you roleplay well with the plots that we send out and you get involved in the game, then you can change what happens on Majesta.
What?
Welcome to LARP.
All right. Back to the topic, though. So the nobility started off as a way to convey leadership and establish clans and family ties, and to sort of rank that structure. And in many cases, it's still supposed to be that way. Like, that's the theory, but in practice, it's not always as clear-cut in terms of rank and who reports to who and all that structure.
Right. So let's go over a list of the house names and their heraldry, and I will put out a disclaimer here that we are doing the heraldry in what is a very bullet point form and have not gotten the beautiful, authentic discourse about what these are. And honestly, that's a lot of talking that is a lot of wrapping your mouth around different words. So this is just going to be a very basic description of their heraldry. So first and foremost is House Achiora, and this is in alphabetical order, not in any other like power order. So House Achiora has the orange head of a griffin on a black field with an orange stripe that goes one goes down one side of the shield. House Brexiano is a white swan on a divided field of tawny and gold.
House Brighthand is a golden eagle on a field of blue and green, hence the blue and green of the Urban Shirian colors. House Camille is a purple orchid in front of a silver stream on a green field.
House Donato is a very striking red sun on a field of silver. And House Falstoke is a golden fox on a divided maroon and blue field.
Lavendros is a silver wolf on a yellow moon on a divided purple field. Stellaci is a phoenix proper on a yellow and blue field.
Van Doren is a silverfish on a field of yellow and green stripes and happens to be one of my favorite heraldry symbols. I really like it. I don't know why. And
duty, honor.
And Winlock is the head of a black stallion with a flaming mane over a divided field of gray and white. So, nobles have manor houses in the areas that where they have holdings, and sometimes they have manor houses, you know, just outside of their holdings or in somebody else's holdings. You know, they like to live big. However, Andy, I just saw your info request about this, so we're not going to talk too much more about this, and you can bring that into game. Cop out.
All right, fine. All right, well, let's talk about how to identify nobles. Nobility higher than squires may wear the symbols and defining colors of their house on their person. They usually do. Even the squires usually wear those symbols. But they may be wearing a circlet as well if they're higher than a squire. Even if they're wearing both, they're definitely nobility. If they're wearing a symbol, like a tabard or something, they may not even be nobility at all, but they could just be high-ranked soldiers or guards. But the circlet is a definite.
Yeah, and it's usually the circlet with the symbol that designates like a high-ranking nobility.
Right.
I know it's a little bit confusing sometimes. We'll send out soldiers that have tabards that have the actual symbol on it, and so people are like, "Oh, is that a noble? Mm-hmm. Is that a noble?" I guess a pretty good rule of thumb is that if they're not wearing a circlet and they're fighting you in a mass melee battle. Probably not nobility.
Yeah.
But yeah, the circlet is one of the defining things of a noble, and especially like we try to make sure that if we're sending out high-ranking nobles that they have both the circlet and the symbol on them. So there are different ways to address the various nobility throughout the kingdom. And this is more of a decorum thing. If you don't address a noble in the correct way, you may get scowled at and may also sometimes get like a slap on the wrist or something like that, depending on the rank of the noble. The more grievous the disregard for their title, it goes up with their rank. So you address a king or a queen with your grace. A prince or a princess is also your grace. A duke or a duchess is my grand liege. Count or countess is my liege. And a viscount and viscountess is my grand lord or lady.
The more common nobles that we'll encounter, descending in order of importance, are barons or baronesses, who you'd address as my lord or good lady. A noble, who you'd address as sir or lady. A knight, who you'd address as sir or madam. And then a squire, who doesn't need a formal address title in front of their name.
Right. And it might also be noted that generally with a lot of these nobles, like you do want to make some sign of respect when they come in, whether it's a bow or kneeling, but mm-hmm. that's not necessary for a squire. If they tell you otherwise, they are fooling you.
they might
try and get you to kneel for them, but you're not going to get punished if you don't. So a noble title is either granted by virtue of birth or it's rewarded to you. And only those who are ranked baron or above may grant that kind of reward title to a commoner. This title is almost always either that of knight or squire. You're not really going to find somebody, making a baron out of a commoner. And it is nearly unheard of for a baron to award the status of noble or higher to somebody who's not already titled. But it has happened, and this is usually, you have to make a petition to a count or a countess or above in order to get that to happen.
Yeah. Most of the time, nobles are nobles because they inherited the title. Title, passes to nobles by birthright, and it gives you the title of noble, which is above knight and squire. It's difficult for nobles who have had their titles granted to them who someone got knighted. Rakesh got knighted at one point
and Haku did
king.
At one point too.
And Haku, yep. It's difficult if you've been granted a title rather than being born into it to progress higher in titles, although it's possible if you marry into the house and then your children would inherit your titles.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
Although I will, put a caveat on there that marrying a commoner, if you are above the title of noble, is kind of looked down upon.
Well, sure.
It's you're mingling with the commoners, and it's if you marry a baron and you're a commoner, you can expect to get the cold shoulder from a lot of other nobility in the area. So a lot of times in game, one of the hardest things that we have to kind of contend with is the fact that, as a general rule, people don't like nobility. They don't like somebody that, there's that general kind of democratic view of the world that we have in the real world where it's like, I don't like the idea that somebody can come in and tell me what to do. And it's like, well, you're in a different world and there are, nobility in a true medieval society, you would have to show them respect or, you would pay the price for that. But, that said, a lot of that is because, most people, especially in the world, commoners misunderstand nobility. Society can't exist without leaders, and Irvin Shear's nobles are leaders, born and bred. It is technically a noble's duty to make sure that the city and the area that he lives in is in the best shape it can be, obviously deferring to those of higher rank. And in times of crisis, it is that noble's duty. It is your ruling noble's duty to lead and plan effectively for that crisis. And it may not seem like it, but in all reality, the nobles are here to serve the commoners.
Right. They have specific jobs that they've been trained to do with specific responsibilities. In theory, those specific responsibilities are based on the level of title, but in reality, it's a little bit more muddied than that. There are some nobles of the same rank who have more or less territory than other nobles of the same rank. Originally, it was the knight's duty to protect the nobles. It was the nobles' duty to enact the baron's will. The barons were in charge of towns, viscounts in charge of larger cities, and the count's duty to oversee a cluster of towns and cities within a specific region. Beyond that, Irvineshire was divided into three separate territories, the farthings, each controlled by a duke. Next, of course, was the king, who ruled over all of Irvineshire, whose today's king is King Adhemar I of House Brighthand.
And today, the dukes and the counts do retain their duties in full, and many towns do have a baron or viscount, but, you know, few small towns have never even seen their baron, and he's never set foot in their town. Again, Elmerton is an anomaly in that aspect, because they have many barons coming in their towns.
We are an anomaly in a lot of respects.
Right.
Let's be honest.
That's true. This is probably the least of those respects.
Yeah.
And besides that, there are more barons and viscounts than there are like viable towns. Like, sure, we have a lot of towns in Irvineshire, and if a baron had, you know, if there's a baron in every town, maybe there would be, you know, enough for an even split. But I think you're going to be hard pressed to find a baron or viscount who wants to have a sole landholding over Ipsenmere. That's the name of it, Ipsenmere. But a baron without a town has no less authority or power. They just, you know, have less responsibility.
So we want to talk about important places within the kingdom.
Particularly the capital, specifically asked where the capital was. Yeah.
Yeah, which is Point Edgar, which is corresponds location-wise to Boston. So some places of importance within there are the King's Palace, King Adhemar's Palace. There's a couple of notable taverns, the Brewmaster's Tavern.
And that's where you can go for an awesome New Year's celebration in April. I'm sorry, New Green.
New Green. There's the Sparkling Bottle Tavern.
I had to put that one in there because my NPC, Amber.
Amber, yeah.
Amber Glass. Wants the Sparkling Bottle. Amber Glass. We also have the Irvineshirean Academy. And there's a grand library in there that a lot of people go to. There's the Raven Skull Bookshop. And there's also the Kinkori Majesty Tower. There's a lot of other things in Point Edgar, but I didn't want to, like, run down our whole list, especially since when you go there, there's people in-game who know a lot of the other pubs and taverns and hotels and stuff, but B, you know, we'll leave some for you to go explore on your own in a travel or something like that.
Exploration, mystery, knowledge to discover.
Exactly.
All right, that's our show. Thanks to Rolaru and Arvili for submitting questions for me to answer, and thanks to Kristen Jacobson for a suggestion for our Legend Lore segment.
And thank you to Paul Dabkowski for your submission to our Command Perform segment.
Thanks again to Sam Rochford for writing our theme music. You can find more of her music at facebook.com/samrochfordmusic, and thank you for listening. Next time on The Magistream, we'll clarify one of Magistry's rules, we'll surprise a listener with a special call and trivia question,
we'll hear another performance from one of our players,
and I will answer more of your inquiries and quandaries. We'll discuss the use of alchemy and toxicology in our Knowledge and Nature segment, and we hope you'll join us.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Introducing the Magistream. Come ask scribe in anything. Be your bridge between the games. People don't understand it. Say I'm too old to believe in magic. The only limit is what you can imagine. So come and listen, la 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 la. So come and listen, la 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 la.
This podcast has been a production of Magistry, copyright P-Dabble Games. You can find out more about our LARP at www.magistry.com or on our Facebook at facebook.com/magistry. You can find our podcast using Podbean and on Magistry's YouTube channel, and we hope to get some more venues up soon, but we'll keep you updated on that. If you have comments, suggestions, feedback, or questions, you can email Andy and I at themagistream@magistry.com.